Here Be Monsters is a show that invites you to explore fear and the unknown.
I saw her face change. I saw her see where I'd pulled my hair out.
Psychological warfare was always considered kind of an oddity, something done by freaks.
On the count of three, we're literally going to step out of our body. Step out.
You can find Here Be Monsters now at kcrw.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
The way the industry works now, I don't get to be the lead in a tiny independent film unless I can bring money to make it. And the only way to do that is to do a combination of a lot of things.
Actress Rebecca Hall immediately connected with a script about TV reporter Christine Chubbuck, who in 1974 shot and killed herself while on the air. But Hall says there's no doing a project like Christine unless she does bigger movies like Marvel's Iron Man 3. Hall tells us why she was so determined to star in Christine, even though her agents were less than enthusiastic about a film with a small budget and a little-known director. And she talks about having most of her role in Marvel's Iron Man 3 cut from the script in the middle of production. But first on the news banter, China beckons with promises of massive rebates. Will Hollywood heed the call? Stay tuned. It's The Business from KCRW. I'm joined by my banter buddy, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So, Matt, this past week or so, the arrival of the head of Wanda. Wanda is a giant Chinese company, the head of which is Wang Jianlin. He is supposed to be Asia's richest man. He's certainly plenty rich. He has been moving into Hollywood. They bought AMC theaters and they have the gigantic theater chains. He bought Legendary, Thomas Tull's company, which had been, you know, producing some high profile movies, got in as producer on some high profile movies like Jurassic World and made money doing that, but then burned a lot of money doing failed movies like Warcraft. So they bought Legendary, Wanda did, and they made an offer to buy slightly less than half of Paramount. That was rebuffed. They are looking to expand, clearly. They are also now, with this arrival of Wang Jianlin, the chairman of this company, trying to bring more production to China. He has constructed a multi-billion dollar, enormous movie production facility in Qingdao, and is offering a, what seems like at least, a tempting fat carrot for the studios to come and make movies there.
Right. He's offering essentially a 40% rebate on productions there with a $750 million development fund. That's a pretty significant incentive to shoot movies there. You know, this was part of a whole rollout that Wanda had. They came to LA, they brought their entire entourage, they got all the studio heads, they got the mayor of LA, they got the president of the Academy into this big presentation with the media and everything. And, you know, this was their big overture. And they want Hollywood studios to produce movies in China for the world audience. And the question now is, are Hollywood producers going to take them up on that offer?
Yeah, I had read in a Hollywood Reporter story, a location manager with a lot of experience in Asia saying sort of archly, I hear on the grapevine that people in Hollywood still have qualms about issues like pollution, systemic corruption, and culture clashes, but money talks. And then he went on to say, when studio execs who make the decisions to send productions over don't necessarily have to spend much time there themselves, I'm sure there will be a healthy flow of production to Qingdao. Now, I don't know if he has some issue with China or Qingdao, but the fact of the matter is, with certain talent, you know, those things are considerations. And there's also considerations of censorship in China, among other things.
Yeah, but I think that the modern history of Hollywood is a search around the world for cheaper production locales. And, you know, actors and directors know these days that if you want to be a successful actor or producer, you've got to be willing to shoot in different parts of the world. And China would just be another part of the world. The question is whether the money is real, in my opinion, whether, you know, there were some questions as to whether the Chinese government portion of this would actually come to fruition. You know, Wanda can make all these promises, but if the government doesn't deliver, it's not going to be real to producers. And I think this is such a an interesting culture where Wanda is so intertwined with the government of China that it's probably real, but who knows?
Who knows? And Wanda's had its issues. I mean, they bought Legendary. A lot of people were very surprised. The price was sort of murky, but maybe $3.5 billion or we don't know. They were going to make a public offering. They promised a lot of investors that they would give them a big premium if they didn't take the company public. And then they were kind of blocked from taking that company public with Legendary all rolled up into one big company. So it's not like anybody has found the course of business to be that smooth in China. And I think, therefore, you know, people will try to get at the money. They always do in Hollywood. But there's going to be a lot of anxiety and wait and see. And it's notable that the first two productions that are going to be there at this Qingdao facility are Legendary productions, which
right, Godzilla 2 and Pacific Rim 2, which are big films, but they're Legendary films.
Right.
They do have some commitments from Lionsgate and from ArcLight, some smaller ones. But the day you see a Disney or Warner Brothers film, you know, commit to be produced at this facility is the day that I think that Hollywood will start embracing it.
Of course, you know, the chance of making your film a co-production, which gets it in under the quota that China allows for outside movies, is another potential part of the package. So much will be revealed as we go forward on this. I mean, China and Hollywood have been sort of circling each other for a while now, and it's still in, I'd say, kind of the nascent stages. Turning to television, something of real concern to the TV networks this year, I don't think they're necessarily, I don't know if they're prepared to admit it, is that the safest of safe things, which was supposed to be football, live, you know, shows that you can't tape and watch later unless you totally block your ears and eyes and don't go on the internet or social media. Football has shown some problems this season. It's really seen some numbers fall. You know, elections are always involved in cutting down football viewership, but not to this degree.
Right. I mean, you're seeing in some cases double-digit declines. And the question now is, why is this happening? And I think there are a number of reasons, everything from the dilution of the game by all these games on Thursday night and on Monday night and on Sunday night and on sometimes Saturday afternoons. That's one explanation. Another might be that, you know, people are finding the game less interesting because of some of the efforts to make it less violent. For protection of the players from head traumas.
That's a dark thought, yes, but possible.
No, it's true. I mean, that's a real thing people talk about. What I believe is happening is I think the election, this is an election unlike previous cycles where, yes, there's always interest, but the ratings we're seeing on these debates and the ratings we're seeing for cable news, I believe that those ratings they're taking away from the football games especially these night games.
I think it's probably a combination. I mean, there is a lot of football available. There's a lot of streaming that people can do. And there is, of course, the election. So it's hard to say. But of course, what makes it so important is that there are very expensive deals in place. And still, football, we should say, is a major draw. It still is very strong comparatively. But if it shows a trend of weakening, then you're really looking at a thing that undercuts the entire broadcast model, which has already been besieged by alternate forms of entertainment and streaming and a million things that make it hard to sustain that model.
Right. This was the one thing that was supposedly the thing that was not impacted by all of those scary things that are causing ratings to decline across the board. But if football isn't immune, then nothing is.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's particularly troubling because the rights fees that have been paid by these networks are just gargantuan. And they're doing that because it's a guaranteed, quote unquote, number. And if it's not guaranteed, then those rights fees are way out of whack.
And there is a memo that the Washington Post obtained, an NFL memo, saying that it was clear that all networks airing NFL games are down and the primetime windows have clearly been affected the most. And so if you like, you know, shows on primetime that you think I don't care about football, just bear in mind that that football revenue is what helps to keep other shows that might be more marginal on the air.
Absolutely.
I'm just going to turn also to something that just is kind of a early rumory thing. Time Warner stock kind of spiked towards the end of the week because of reports that Time Warner was in talks with AT&T about a possible deal, merger, something. Now, you remember Rupert Murdoch went hammer and tong after Time Warner a few years ago. $75 billion offer, give or take. This one would have to be significantly richer, I guess. There's been an impression that Time Warner, ultimately that Jeff Bukas, the chairman of Time Warner, wants to sell. And it seems to me that whether or not a deal with AT&T materializes, he's certainly nudging the company in play by acknowledging that there has been any kind of conversation with AT&T.
Yeah, I mean, this would be a gigantic merger if it does happen. The ecosystem here would be completely upended because Time Warner, of course, owns the Warner Brothers film studio, the cable networks TNT and TBS, as well as HBO. And the combination with an AT&T DirecTV, which is owned by AT&T now, that would just put so much power in the hands of one company. It would create a gigantic superpower in media.
So we don't know if it would pass muster, even if they go ahead and figure out the terms. I mean, we're talking about something like a $100 billion deal. But, you know, I can imagine Rupert Murdoch and maybe some others. I've even heard Leslie Moonves casting an eye and trying to figure out how he might get into that ownership of Time Warner. You know, everybody who's even thought about it now is thinking about it much harder and much faster. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, executive editor of The Hollywood Reporter. In Christine, actress Rebecca Hall portrays 29-year-old TV news reporter Christine Chubbuck, who on July 15, 1974, shot and killed herself during a live broadcast in Sarasota, Florida. Hall portrays Chubbuck as colleagues remembered her, as a serious reporter battling mental health issues. She pines for a promotion that would take her to a bigger station in Baltimore, but her boss, played by Tracy Letts, tells her she's not turning in the kind of stories that can help him boost the station's sagging ratings.
Well, so what? Get some footage of some fat people burning in a car crash and I'm on a plane to Baltimore? Is that what you're saying?
Now you're being a smartass. What's your problem, Miss Chubbuck? You're a feminist. You think that the way to get ahead is by talking louder than the other guy. That's the whole movement in a nutshell.
Oh, so you're saying that I'm not fit for a bigger market because I'm a woman?
No, I'm saying that there's no respect for institutions of authority. You're the smartest person here. If you took half the energy you used to give me a hard time and just did what I'm asking you to do...
I'm just trying to understand what you're saying.
Jesus Christ, just make your stories juicy.
Christine was written and produced by first-time feature writer Craig Shilowich and directed by Antonio Campos. They first approached Hall about playing Chubbuck before they even had funding for the film.
The script wasn't entirely finished. It wasn't entirely what you see when I read it, but I read a version of it that was pretty close. They were at the stage of trying to, you know, get together a cast that would help get it green lit. It wasn't particularly a very easy project to finance.
I should think not, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, sadly, because I think it's a bit of a unicorn of a film. It's, you know, it's got substance. It's about something. It's also, it's in the vein of some of the kind of classic tragedies. But there's a woman in the center of it, which is unusual. Anyway, it was difficult to finance. I got attached to it, and then it was about a year of trying to find people to take the risk and do it. And then eventually they did.
And you, obviously, I'm assuming you saw this role and you thought, I can really get into this. This is like an amazing role for me to really find some range and do a thing.
I did, absolutely. I was tremendously moved by the story. The fact that I hadn't heard of Christine Chubbuck. And then I, of course, Googled to see what was out there. And you realize that it is a small-known story that sort of exists on the, for want of a better word, annals of the internet on the sort of five most shocking things that ever happened on television.
Right. List,
which is reductive and which is can be a sort of voyeuristic interest,
yes,
a sort of sensationalistic interest.
I think I read somewhere where people are chasing after the tape.
Exactly.
And say they've seen the tape sometimes.
Which seems to me to be a kind of, just a kind of sort of empty endeavor. Like, why do you, nobody needs to see that. It's done. It was a horrible thing. It was a horrible tragedy. Should not have happened. It was an extreme act of violence that she committed both to herself and to other people. But I suppose what I felt reading the script was I realized if we don't make this film, then that's how she exists forever. And this sort of five-line reductive thing of sort of, well, she's a crazy person. And when I read the script, I was so moved by there's a vein of compassion that ran through the writing then and feeling to try and humanize this person and to try and understand, and also the how it resonates in a sort of social historical context and so many different reasons. I found it to be very prescient. And, you know, I suppose the thing that really got me, I didn't just start leaping around and think, oh, here's my sort of great role. It wasn't that, because it's a scary one. It's a scary one to have to humanize someone who did something like that, because I think it's fairly simple to humanize the characters who are heroic and virtuous and do good things. For me, as an actor, it's crucial to humanize the ones that we'd rather look away from. And I saw in this script that opportunity, and I felt that it was necessary because I felt such compassion for this person.
So I read that Craig Shilowich, who wrote the script, had had his own issues with mental illness, and that was partly what drew him to this subject matter.
Well, absolutely. He had a very clear line to it. Honestly, when I read it, one of the things that struck me, you know, it wasn't a sort of call my agent, yes, I'll do it situation. Right. They wanted to meet me, and I wanted to meet them, because part of me was a little bit like, well, you know, this isn't a uniquely feminine story. She's in every frame of the movie. What's the motivation behind the two guys that want to make this? Not that I'm suggesting that men can't tell brilliant stories about women. They have historically many, many a time. But I wanted to know where they were coming from.
Of course.
Because there are many ways to make this film. You know, there are many bad ways to make this film. And I wanted to know that they were coming to it from the right way. And I sensed in the script that there was something, but I wanted to know. And one of the things that came out in the meetings was that Craig had a protracted battle with depression in his 20s, very serious depression that came out of nowhere and left just as quickly. And one of the things that helped him out of it was in some way finding work that he thrived in and loved. And when he was researching something else, he came across, you know, one of these five-line reductive statements about Christine on the internet. And instead of having the kind of cool guy hipster response, which is, you know, he had a very serious connection with it, because he looked at it and immediately thought, wow, imagine if I had had what I was dealing with, but been a woman. Mm. And more than that, but been a woman in the 70s in a hostile work environment. And more than that, had my work taken away from me, would I have made it? I don't know.
Well, I'd also read another point, which was that it would be very simple to make out that she was this fantastic talent who was thwarted by the evil establishment.
No, that's absolutely not what this film does.
I mean, I was thinking from his point of view, if he was having this issue of depression and found his way out through work, the idea of a person who's also suffering from issues and is not as great at the work, that then makes that not a great escape from then that one would be an interesting thing to explore from somebody's point of view who had been through that. One of the things I like about the movie a lot is the way the people around her, they're not just one-note awful people. They may be more or less smart or...
No, but it's very... when I say there's so much humanity in this film, I just mean it's dealing with people, regular people. There's no judgment in it. There's everyone is going through their stuff. You know, everyone is being hit with what life hits them with. And the majority of the people that you are with in the movie have the tools to deal with it. And there's one who you're asked to spend the movie with who doesn't have the tools. And I suppose what I feel quite strongly about this film is that there is something that we can all relate to here, which is difficult to come to terms with, because we all know what it feels like to be stymied at work, and we all know what it feels like to get depressed from time to time, and we all know what it feels like to be unloved or feel isolated or have professional personal disappointments. What the film asks you to think about is how easy it is to go that extra bit were it not for the arbitrary circumstances of social, historical time and place, gender and brain chemistry. Like that, you know, these sort of random factors which added to that could push any one of us over the edge. Not in the precise way that she did, but push any one of us over the edge. And I find that moving.
Coming up after a short break, Rebecca Hall tells us about being cast as the villain in Iron Man 3 and then watching Marvel slash her role. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Select sessions from KCRW's music program, Morning Becomes Eclectic, can be experienced in the immersive world of virtual reality. download KCRW's VR app to get lost in the music. Go to kcrw.com/VR.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to the actress Rebecca Hall, star of Christine. The film follows the final days of Christine Chubbuck, a TV reporter in Florida who in 1974 committed suicide live on TV. In the film, Chubbuck has an unrequited crush on the station's anchorman, George, played by Michael C. Hall. She's thrilled when he finally asks her to dinner. But what the troubled Christine sees as a date turns out to be George's attempt to help her by taking her to a New Age therapy session in which participants answer rapid-fire questions about their lives.
I really wish that I could get a job promotion.
Why don't you ask for one?
Yes, but they say I have to do different work.
Why don't you try a compromise?
Yes, but, and I won't be doing the work that I love.
Why don't you do different work?
Yes, but if I do different work, then I won't be doing the work with the man that I love.
Christine was well-received at this year's Sundance Film Festival, with Hall receiving lots of critical praise for her performance. The film is open in select markets and will continue to roll out throughout the fall. So you're looking at your career and you're wanting to build a career, mm-hmm. and you get this script. I mean, I just wonder whether you sit with your agent and say, now this one could be a fabulous movie, but it'll be a tough sell. I mean, is that a conversation that your representation has with you?
Of course. They do. You know, there was a moment where it was, we don't really know what this film is, and it's not like there's a massively famous director attached that will give the machinery and blah, blah, blah. It's a very small budget, and it might disappear, and you'll put your heart and soul into it. And, you know, all that kind of chat did happen. I just had an instinct about this one, and I really hope I'm not wrong, but it feels like the conversations that this story raises, what she signifies, she's such a harbinger of so many things that we as a culture are dealing with right now, that we want to talk about right now, whether it's issues of mental health, whether it's issues around suicide rates, whether it's issues around what it is to be a woman in the workplace and how we judge that differently, the likability factor, media, news as spectacle. Yes, okay, it's a difficult marketing plan, but to me it felt like it would capture something so significant that people will go and see it on word of mouth.
And you were able to talk to some of her colleagues, I think, but the family was not.
Craig Shilowich went and spoke to friends and co-workers in Sarasota, Florida. Both him and Tony advised me not to. And I agree with them, because I had to have the freedom to create the version of Christine that was faithful to the writing and that I could universalize and that I could make personal and make true to me. I think the question of sort of talking to people that knew her is complicated. She was a person who was hiding an awful lot by all accounts. And the things that I would like to know about Christine Chubbuck go to the grave with her.
Is it correct that the family didn't want to be involved?
There aren't that many
relatives
left. There is one and they did not want to be involved. And I understand. You know, we all understand. It is hugely regrettable when any media covers factual issues and the people that are caught up or the victims are caught up don't want the thing to be dealt with. Of course they don't. For them, it is a private trauma.
Right.
However, if something's in the public domain, it's, as this was, it's a public tragedy, and it is in many ways the responsibility of art to grapple with the questions that leaves a society and puts out there. You know, otherwise we'd all not be doing things that we're doing, media or otherwise.
So swiveling to the opposite end of the marketing universe, mm-hmm. you were in Iron Man 3.
Yeah.
Which is the biggest machine Marvel movies, or, you know, I can't think of a bigger machine, Disney, Marvel. That's a big machine. Mm-hmm. And your role was changed, which, talking about the role play of women in the workplace, mm-hmm, in the, mm-hmm. you were going to be...
I know, ironic, isn't it?
Yeah, just sort of everywhere. You were going to be the principal villain.
Yeah.
I read, you did an interview in Toronto, I think, and you said you were eager to talk about this, and I'm eager to hear.
No, it was just funny to me, because Shane Black referenced it in this interview when he was promoting The Nice Guys.
He said that they had suddenly sort of tapped him on the shoulder.
Well, he was talking about two different... There were two different phases of this. So there was a phase way before I was involved where, you know, there was a female villain that was running through it that then got reduced to it being a female villain and a male villain. And that's when I got on board. And then halfway through the filming of that, then they came along and basically said, I think we're going to kill you off halfway through the movie, which initially I was all the way to the end.
So it was funny to me because Shane Black said that, and then I was doing a bunch of press for this and something else, and nobody asked me. Nobody ever asked me. And I was sort of thinking, oh, well, I'll wait and I'll find a sort of moment to talk about it. And then this one guy in Toronto.
God bless him.
I was like,
somebody doing his job.
This is not intended, but you're the first person to ask me this. So, yeah.
Well, so when that happens, it's because they think they'll sell more toys if the villain is a guy.
Well, they did. Look, to be fair to Marvel, they are righting a lot of their wrongs right now by casting Brie Larson as, you know, they're doing some good. So I don't want to scream and shout about it a lot because I think they are really doing a lot of good right now. But it's just sad, you know? It's like, surely we can do better than this. I mean, actually, women at the front of films do sell out theatres very well. I don't know why there's this lag in the sort of cultural understanding in the sort of the higher-ups that won't see
it
this.
It seems that every time there is a female-led movie that works, everybody goes, oh, well, that's a one-off.
Right, yeah. So, like, no, weirdly, I know, and it shouldn't be a thing. It shouldn't be a thing.
And we are obviously more than half the population.
When people talk about Christine, they'll often compare it to other films that have a woman at the center, but aside from that, have very little to do with this film. And I sort of think, I understand what you're saying, and I'm very flattered that you're comparing it to X, Y, and Z. But actually, if you're going to compare it to anything, something like Taxi Driver feels more relevant to the thing. You know what? If like there are more male-led films that feel more relevant comparison to this one than the sort of
the woman.
Yeah, but
time.
It's the, you know, and I always find that interesting.
Like, frustrating,
okay.
I should
frustrating.
Think. Well, so when you choose to do obviously this movie is your artistic passion, and with Iron Man, what are you thinking? Just what the hell? Or I'll get a better profile in the United States and that could be good? Or
look, honestly, the way the industry works now, I don't get to be the lead in a tiny independent film unless I can bring money to make it. And the only way to do that is to do a combination of a lot of things, like to raise the profile, do all of that stuff. Otherwise, I wouldn't have a career. It's not like I'm sitting around going, oh, what can I cherry pick from here? Everything is monetized. Everything is strategic. The industry is in a state of flux because of everything that's been happening. And, you know, and with the internet and Netflix, you know, there's so many different things going on that the independent film market is shifting. You know, increasingly things are made for smaller and smaller and smaller budgets, like even since I've been working. And it is what it is, but if I don't have the profile to help one of those films like this one get made, then I'm sort of stuck out in the cold not doing anything that I want to do. So.
Right. So it's a practical thing.
It's practical, but I also, you know, I also have the good fortune to be able to, so far, like get to do the ones that I thought have been pretty fun to do if I'm going to do one of those films. You know, I'm not going to just do anything. I'm going to, because there's plenty
not.
Of good stuff that's on the, you know, I'm not.
I mean, you know, Marvel is famous for playing real hardball and they don't want to pay and it's tough, but
right.
It's the profile, I think, is probably, it can't be replicated. And so, I mean, those things go around the world and it's a gigantic
absolutely. And
explosion.
Absolutely. People love them. I'm not,
and
you know, I'm not,
them,
I'm, not gonna,
yeah.
I'm not turning my nose up at that. I mean, they serve a really important place in the culture. You know, everything
fun
is valid. Exactly, fun.
I think fun is a good thing.
Fun is a very good thing.
Do you feel like it's one for me and one for them, like one for the Marvel type movies? And
no,
then
it's never that strategic. Unfortunately, I wish it was that clear cut. It's
right.
Always a little bit like, oh, I enjoyed that. I wasn't expecting to enjoy that. Or this turned out differently. Or that's not, you know. But this one is totally unusual for me because it genuinely was a case of a group of people sit in a room and say, let's set out to do a thing. We're going to do it like this and it's going to be like this. And nearly always, you know, you watch the film, it's like, oh, it's not quite what we'd said, but it's better or it's worse or here and there and there. And this is one of those occasions where I watch the film and I come out and, you know, we look at each other and we're like, oh, you know, that thing we set out to do, it's there.
That's a fantastic feeling.
Yeah.
Rebecca Hall is the star of Christine. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance this week from Kat Yore and Mario Diaz. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.